My name is Mushta Bhatt, and it's my honor and privilege to share this session. We have three presenters today. And this is, as you all know, it's a session which is a part of our 2010 conference on how class works, sponsored by the Center for Study of Class Life. Our first presenter is Abhijan Gurel. And he's a PhD candidate at Waukesha University, the Tuscarora Institute for Modern Turkish History, and is teaching modern history. Modern Turkish history as an instructor in the same institute. Abhijan is interested in labor movement, sociology of working class, and Islam. Abhijan also does some part-time work for the unions and often engages in volunteer labor activism. It's my honor to present
Thank you very much. Good morning for everybody. I actually had a quite interesting and good PowerPoint presentation, all that which is another, but you will see my bad English and my English, right? Sorry about that. My presentation will be on a neighborhood in Istanbul, which is basically a Turkish class neighborhood. And I will read my presentation if you stay for it. Today I will present the beginning part of my research, which I am conducting for my dissertation. It's a theoretical question is that. What is the relationship between the subjectivity and agency of those workers with the concept of working class in particular? The term class will be problematized and conceived as a possible and contingent intertwined outcome of structural conditions and agency. Since class is classified, as Bourdieu told us, and or class is to be made or unmade, as he also said, by the symbolic material and political struggles. I have some relations with the neighborhood since 2007, and I rent an apartment and began to my research since last February. I collect data by using participant observation methods, and for the time being, I made in-depth interviews with 22 residents, and of course, daily conversations with many others. It is impossible to embrace all of the uncountable dimensions of daily life in the neighborhood, of course, in this presentation. Thus, I will focus on the urban, working, and religious experiences of the working class members of that neighborhood. I follow Sheorten's definitions of subjectivity and agency. She says that subjectivity is the ensemble of modes of perception, affect, thought, desire, and fear that animate acting subjects. But I always mean as well the cultural and social formations that shape, organize, and provoke those modes of affect, thought, and so on. Also, she continues, I see subjectivity as the basis of agency, a necessary part of understanding how people act on the world even as they are acted upon. Agency is not some natural or original view. It takes shape as specific desires and intentions within a matrix of subjectivity, of culturally constituted feelings, thoughts, and meanings. With the inspiration of E.P. Thompson, Arif Dilik argues that the possibility to engage in a truly liberating practice depends on the success of following the dialect between the liberatory consciousness and the consciousness of the social present. To understand the consciousness of the social present, the concepts of subjectivity and agency are, I think, useful. This knowledge will be meaningful to interact with for strengthening the liberatory practices and politics in Turkey, of course. That's pretty much my main goal. Okay. I will first talk very briefly about the general situation of labor in Turkey, because it's important to understand the identities of those people in the neighborhood. I mean, Turkey is one of the countries which is very harshly hit by the global crisis of the workers' movements in the era of flexible accumulation, as Harvey puts it. The military coup of 1980 was the watershed in this process. It was a political coup. Military regime banned all strikes and active unions, and many unions were jailed. In the following years, the union law was changed and the neoliberalization program was imposed. The impacts of liberalization might be present under four headings, just to have in mind. First is the growing exclusion from the working life. Second is the rise of temporary employment, as you know. The third is the downfall of the employees' earnings. And the fourth is the decline of the unions. I mean, to understand the growing exclusion from the working life, in the case of Turkey, we should have in mind that we had a huge agricultural population, but since 1980, there was a huge influx into cities because of the liberalization programs, and I can just give the number that, I mean, it used to be the percentage of people living in the agricultural areas used to be 56 in 1998. After the liberalization program of, you know, three decades, it went down to 24% of the people. It was a huge, you know, influx. But, you know, as we can guess that the industrial sector or the service sector is not that much increasing, so obviously the difference become the, you know, numbers of the huge unemployed people. And the, I mean, unemployment rates about Turkey, they are not much trustable, you know, because they are driven by the governments. Like the official rates are for, let's say, 2008, it is 9%. In this year, I mean, 2009 and 10, obviously the crisis, it went up to 14%. But the trick is there. I mean, we have this same, but I guess also American statistics, I guess, have that labor force participation rate. It used to be in Turkey, it used to be in 1988, the labor force participation rate used to be 58% in Turkey, but it is 48% in 2009. So, you know, this actually 10% is actually unseen in the unemployed statistics, but they are practically unemployed. I won't get into much details about the German police, but I also want to say, I have the graph, but I will try to interpret that. The percentage of unionized workers also decreased tremendously. In 97, it was 33%. It raised because the 70s were like the great years of working class settlement in Turkey. It became 35%. But after 1980, I mean, after the coup, it went down like that, and it is around 5% right now. It's like a huge increase after the coup, okay? Which is very obvious, like the relationship with all those military guys, you know? I will now talk about the neighborhood. It's called Kitali. I will practically call it Kitali. I have the maps, but I will try to make you understand it. It's at the west side of Istanbul. If you know Istanbul, it's in Turkey, in the Bosporus, you might know there. It's at the west side of Istanbul. It is not that far from the center of the city, but it is still not far. You have to take bus and go there, like from the, let's say, you might know the historical peninsula, maybe you might know. You have to go like 1.5 hours of bus riding to go there. It's kind of far, but not really. Even though the neighborhood I do my research, this is important. The neighborhood borders are quite clear since in the north of the neighborhood there is a huge highway of Istanbul, like the second biggest highway of Istanbul. And also at the immediate north of that highway there is a huge Italy organized industrial zone, which is a huge industrial zone. It's supposed to employ 300,000 people, but it's right now around like 150,000 people are employed. That is quite huge. In the west and south of the neighborhood, we have a mass housing area, which is like middle income earning people, I can say. And in the east of the neighborhood, there is a motorway rightly going to the highway. So it's a quite, I mean, manageable neighborhood. It's quite separated from its surroundings. And the official data is around 9,000 people are living there. The area used to have some historical background. The area used to have few settlements before 1980, and it put migration and developed into a neighborhood in the second half of 1980s due to the establishment of that organized industrial zone in 1985. It is a low-income area, of course, in which mostly blue-collar or low-skilled service families are living. It used to be a gecekondu neighborhood. It's a Turkish word. It practically means migrant houses, mostly informally, single-story, and of course low-quality houses, which literally means built overnight. It's basically something like a shanty, as you know, but they are not as bad as maybe you can imagine. They also used to be not that bad also in the old days. It has been reasons, but that's supposed to skip that. But in the 90s, parallel with other gecekondu neighborhoods in Istanbul, the residents turned their gecekondus into low-quality apartments. The streets are strikingly long and straight in Italy, which is a rare case in terms of the ex-gecekondu areas. Thanks to the early engagement of the public institution into the determination of the parcels of the buildings, you know. Halk Alınmaz housing area, actually I thought that, I mean, it was a publicly led, a huge mass housing project, and the residents are usually lower middle class people. Like mostly white color, but not like professional, you know, but like more white colors. Even though there are many workers employed in the new organized industrial zone, and also in the other low slash factories, the distribution centers of cargo companies were also there. It's also important. There are also many people who work in far workplaces. There is an obvious tendency of the decline of industrial employment, since the large scale factories have been moving to further industrial zones. Actually, outside of Istanbul, they are even moving from that far place, you know, even further places. Many researchers of Turkish employment structure point that the petty entrepreneurship is quite common in urban areas of Turkey, and Italy seems to be no exception. A large portion of the shopkeepers, tradesmen, or small businessmen in the neighborhood also live in the neighborhood. They obviously have a great impact on the, you know, social atmosphere of the neighborhood. Like, they are like more like the leaders of the neighborhood, actually. After this introductory information about the neighborhood, I will discuss three points about it in more detail. First is migrant communities and urban life in the neighborhood. Second is working life, and of course I will also focus about class struggles, you know, at the workplace. And the third, if I will have time, the third will be the religious life of the residents, which is, I think, very important. First one, migrant communities and urban life in the neighborhood. The population of the neighborhood is very varied in terms of ethnicity, religious sects, and places of birth, representing almost a microcosmos of Turkish society. To make it easier, I mean, it's actually much more complicated, but to make it easier to conceive, probably for non-natives, I will only mention three major communities. The first one is the majority of Turkish and Sunni people, led by those from Black Sea region of Turkey, which is the northern part of the Turkey. You might know the Black Sea, and you know the region there we call Black Sea region. Sunni means what? Of course, I should also say something about that. Sunni is one of the two major sects of Islam, which is, we can say, more majority also globally, around, I guess, 80% probably. This is important, I mean. Also in Turkey, they are a large majority. I mean, we have two sects, I know this coming. The second community is a large minority of Alevi people. What is Alevi? Alevi is an umbrella term for the heterodox and local ethno-religious communities, mostly peculiar to Turkey, or let's say, ex-Ottoman Empire, let's say. Alevis had always been a quite small minority, and they always have been oppressed by the Ottoman Empire, which is identified itself with Sunni sect, with the majority sect. And the same oppression or the same segregation between Alevis and Sunnis also very much present right now. The third one, which is also very important, a smaller minority of Kurdish people. I'm sure you all know about the Kurdish issue in Turkey. I will also come back to that. So there are basically, I mean, we can kind of simplify by saying there are three communities, but they are actually, as you can get it, like they are actually huge coalitions of many other smaller communities, actually. Okay, we have to keep that in mind. It is widely stated by urban sociologists of Turkey that fellow countrymen communities have been essential for the adaptation and survival of the migrants in the cities. Those communities have been and continue to be the most effective social forces in the urban space of migrants. And Kitab also is no exception in a sense, both in the real life and in the organizational space and also in the local politics. The fellow countrymen communities are the most powerful identities and social forces. There are numerous societies of fellow countrymen in the area, and actually those communities are usually as specific as referring to particular villages of the migrants, actually. When they come together, they build these huge coalitions of like those from Lexington, you know. The bigger communities, like those from the region of a particular city, or as large as those from Lexington region, are actually very dynamic, fluid, and temporary coalitions. There are tens of fellow countrymen associations, which are practically actually tea houses for men. They are the public places for the men to socialize, play cards, games, and all that. But those associations are not only places of leisure, but they also provide small-scale solidarity among co-locals in many cases. Also, they provide networks to find jobs or opportunities of investment. They also are very, very, very powerful in the local politics. Okay. Most of the people from Black Sea region and also western region of Turkey, west of Istanbul, have some piece of land back in their villages, which helps the reproduction of their close relations with their hometowns. Some of them even travel to their villages in the harvest time, and they harvest actually their crops, which is for Black Sea region, hazelnut. You might have heard about this. Pretty much the best hazelnut in the world. Others' land is harvested by some relatives in the villages. Thus, even though usually very low amount, of course, they gain some additional income from agriculture, and also many middle-aged workers from those regions want and actually practically plan to go back to their hometowns after they marry and settle, you know, their children in Istanbul. This is their like goal, their, you know, fantasy. To buy or build a house in the hometowns is a very popular desire. People work on the hard labor. Kurdish and Alevi, the minority sect, Alevi population are concentrated in the west side of the neighborhood. A Cemevi, which is a peculiar temple of Alevis, is actually there in this area, which also reveals the existence and also the size of the Alevi population. On the other hand, in the east side, most of the inhabitants are from Black Sea region, like those Sunni guys, Turkish Sunni guys, people. Kurdish, Alevi, and Turkish Sunni communities are not strictly separated from each other spatially, but the concentration of the communities obviously differs. An interesting account about the impact of those communities is following. The elected headman, we have local elections, the elected headman of the northern neighborhood is actually a Kurd, which was very unexpected, like everybody became shocked. The reason is following. The fellow countrymen societies of different cities from the Black Sea region have actually made an agreement to nominate and support only one candidate among themselves, you know. But somehow, it's a long story, but somehow this alliance had broken up, and in the last election, just 1 year ago, in the last election, each community from Black Sea region nominated their own candidates. So their votes became divided, and the Kurdish candidate get the election, and speech was, you know, as you can guess, like pissed off the old Black Sea people because of those racist and nationalist, you know, tensions. The traditional and religious sectarian segregation between Sunni Muslim majority and Alevi Muslim minority is very much alive and present. Likewise, the modern and nationalist and of course racist segregation between Turks and Kurds is actually much more lively, and it is very sensitive to the national developments, the related Kurdish question. Namely, the struggle between the Turkish armed insurgent groups, you might not be taking, and the Turkish state. And actually, to make you understand how PKK is supported by the Kurds, that guy, that Kurdish guy who won the election, was actually from the party of legal branch of PKK. So this is actually a reality. The situation in the neighborhood is not as strict as those different communities live totally segregated from each other, of course, but especially between Turks and Kurds, there are growing prejudices. Even though on their left they live together, they work together, but they still have those prejudices, unfortunately. Most of the discourse among Turks about Kurds points that the Kurds are supporting the PKK, of course, and they also claim, which is more, I think, daily, let's say, the Turks claim that Kurds are responsible of the social ills of the neighborhood, you know, like drugs, fights, or all other types of like small pit crimes, you know. Because actually Kurds claim to be by Turks as uneducated and giving birth to many children who became troublemakers on the street. I guess it's very heavenly for you, you know. But this is a new issue. I mean, the interpretation of the issue, just like in that term, is actually quite new phenomenon in Turkey, because Kurds were all pulled off from their neighbors, from their own land because of the war. But besides these external segregations, those communities internally provide a wide web of close relations to those hardworking people, which produce a lively, communal and joyful atmosphere, actually. Starting from the close relatives living in the same actually building or in the same street, to the people of the same village, there is a sense and practice of community among them, in between them, since people have very close daily relations, especially women, of course. Spaces of those relations are houses during the family visits, those numerous tea houses for men, streets, and numerous weddings. I mean, in the summertime, like we have like 10 weddings in the same weekend. Also, in front of the apartments, the sidewalk, especially for women, because they can't go very far, you know, they have to be around the street. These are the spaces of those relations, I mean. For men, of course, those networks in the neighborhood cross much behind, much beyond the family or fellow countrymen relations. Thus, the street actually is a very lively place. I mean, you always can see a lot of people, you always see high to like tens of people when you walk on the street. This atmosphere provides a very comfortable and relaxing effect in the sphere of so-called reproduction. Beyond its psychological and social impact, these relations do provide, although moderate, financial and material help for each other also. Obviously, these webs are not relevant for everyone, since there are also many isolated households in the neighborhood, but as far as I can see, they are very small minority. Besides this positive atmosphere provided by the community relations, the street is also a negative place. Why? Besides the positive atmosphere, the street is also a very negative place, of course, because parents claim about their children, you know, because there are very, very few places for children to play and all that. Also, there are too much crime, also, actually. Stuff like that. I'm skipping to cover my time limitations. I will also, let's say, talk a very little about work and conclude, work and life. I mean, I can say that maybe like more easily. There are very few, actually, collective cases of working class studies. As you can guess, it's about the crisis of working class in general. As far as I can find out, there are only like 4 cases of collective class struggles around the neighborhood, which involves the residents from the neighborhood in the last 3 years. One was a unionization struggle in 2007 and 2008 in a gun factory. It was actually achieved, but unfortunately the factory moved away, so they all became extremists. The other one was about small garment workshops inside the neighborhood. People, like those workers, became mobilized because they don't get their payments for 3 months, approximately. And also the bosses claimed bankruptcy, so they just ran away, you know. They left those people. They were, of course, very much pissed off, and they occupied the workplaces to get the machines, you know, because they thought that they can only get their money by selling those machines. It was quite interesting. Also, one of those mobilizations, they made a barricade on that highway, which was quite interesting and unusual for Turkey. They became publicized, and the news came there. The last one is actually more interesting, maybe. You all know UPS, cargo company. There is just right now a going on unionization struggle, which is very like, just like crossing the road. There's a huge UPS center. The carrier workers are trying to unionize there. But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, like those mobilizations are not very much known or supported by the community, you know, because there's not like that kind of a specific sensitivity on those kinds of unfortunate struggles. But like on the more real life, I mean, you can kind of observe a kind of criticism of workers towards their employers. I mean, almost all workers somehow, you know, they talk about their bosses in a very negative way, and some sayings are very popular, like a worker is always oppressed. This is very common among workers when they are like talking to them. But of course, I should say that the talking about work is not a very popular, you know, because people don't like the work and they don't do anything in terms of like more agency in their work. So they usually talk about other things in their life. But whenever the issue comes up, people usually say stuff like that. I mean, a worker is always oppressed. The one who is burdened or suffered is always worker, especially in the context of the crisis, you know. The boss always tell people that, you know, we are in crisis, we can't make any wage increases in this year, I'm sorry. You know, stuff like that people talk about. But and actually, there are also actually many, not like unionization, like many small kind of collective resistance, like in small cases. But as you can guess, the ones who make those kind of resistances, they are usually dismissed of their working place. So, I mean, also, just last part about the working life. I mean, in Turkey, there's a real and imaginary opportunities of upper mobility among workers, actually, to become a small petty entrepreneur is actually really not that hard, actually. And as we can also guess, it is also imagined as much more easy than it really is. But there is a very wide discourse that people dream about, people think about, people try to become small entrepreneurs in the neighborhood. This is also very important in terms of working life. About religion, actually, I guess I should skip that, not to get the time for other representatives. Just to conclude, I mean, I can say that, I mean, it's obvious that other identities are much more hegemonic on the urban space, but it is not that that a worker identity is totally non-existent, obviously. And another maybe important point, which was mostly about religion, but people are religious, I mean, in terms of discourse, but it doesn't mean that a pious worker is very, you know, passive against their employers, because there are also many cases that very pious workers are also can do, of course, whatever they can do in the existing huge places. But I mean, those identities are not necessarily contradictory, maybe, with class identities, which are left in our country and also our unions are not too much aware of, unfortunately. We usually use a very, how can I say, like very secular and very clean identity of worker, and we also seek for it, and when we can't find it, we became, you know, what can I say, like, sorry, you know, who is the worker, like the queer secular worker. Maybe we should, you know, make our understanding more, you know, real. Sorry. For
shop steward and rank and file union activist who now teaches courses in labor history and contemporary labor issues as an assistant professor in the labor studies program at Indiana University, Bloomingdale. The title of his topic is Geographies of Class in South Central Indiana.
Thanks, Alcan. Your presentation reminded me of a great story. This New York author in the station who talks about his grandparents moving to the Lower East Side from southern Italy in the turn of the last century, and they were from one village, and they took this tenement, and people from the other village took this tenement across the street. And his father married his mother, who lived in the building across the street, and his father's parents thought that that was marrying a foreigner.
So, does anybody know who this quote is from? A little bit more to it.
It was going to be part of my PowerPoint presentation. Ideally, which I put on your slide, you know about Mark. Exactly. Bill knows. Bill gets today's prize. That's from Jack, you know, the guy that wrote the biography where he's on the cover. He's, I mean, he's a celebrity CEO. Jack Welch, who's a GE CEO. This is his quote, and this is in part what my presentation is going to be about today. Not so much. I'm not doing so much. Concentrate on GE itself. I'm actually going to concentrate on the GE workers and other workers in South Central Indiana and what they do and what the kind of space they create. So Welch is talking about how you'd like to be able to move and follow the labor markets and follow the cheapest labor markets, but of course you can't do that as a company. So what I'm going to talk about today, the title of the presentation, I had a nice little five-thing PowerPoint thing so that you can look at and not get bored. I may actually read my paper because I like this paper. I usually don't read the side. I'll just wing it. But I think I'm going to read this paper. And the presentation is called Geographies of Class in South Central Indiana. And what I'm going to do is, actually, I'm going to talk about what Andrew Herod would probably call class geographies rather than the geography of class. He distinguishes between the geography of labor, which is what David Harvey calls the spatial fix. So the geography of labor is how capitalist corporations move from place to place based on having to accumulate and make profit and circulate capital, right? So that's their spatial fix. What Herod and other labor geographers have been talking about is the geography is labor geographies, how workers themselves produce space and produce geographic changes. And not only in reaction to the movements of capital, but based on their own interests, which what I'm going to try to say here is that they are oftentimes class interests, but they're not always class interests. They are sometimes in resistance to capital, but not always. They are oftentimes actually dividing of solidarities within the working class itself. So they are fragmenting processes within the working class itself. So I'm going to read a little bit from here, and I'm going to say that, you know, we're at the point where Edward Sawyer said 20 years ago, in 1989, postmodern geographies, we need to take space seriously. And I think that that has actually happened. There's a lot of people doing this type of work. And what Sawyer meant was that space disrupts those mean narratives that we put together about, say, what a working class should do. So we all have our ideas about, well, the working class should develop their consciousness and then they should resist capitalism. But when you put in an actual analysis of the existing space and how they produce space, it sort of disrupts those narratives. And that's kind of the work that I try to do, is look at how spatial production can be both a form of solidarity and a form of fragmentation. So
That's my spatial approach, and I think it's really important for understanding class and the subject of this conference, which is how class works, so how class produces space. I would also like to talk about briefly the point of study for this paper, South Central Indiana. So what I'm presenting today is part of a project that I've just started. I'm hoping to turn it into a long-term project. I hope down the road to turn it into a book. And I'm mainly studying South Central Indiana since the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994. If those of you may know Jeff Cowie's work, his work was called Capital Moves. If you've never read it, it's a really great work on the spatial fit. So Jeff Cowie wrote this book called Capital Moves. And he examined South Central Indiana and RCA, how it moved to South Central Indiana, because basically you had an unorganized potential working class in South Central Indiana. RCA had located its main plant in Camden, New Jersey. Camden became unionized. Union workers became radical. The move, the spatial fix, was to move to South Central Indiana. And RCA thought, oh, we're moving to this place where there are no unions, where the workforce is going to be passive. And what they found after a while of being there was that the workforce, of course, organized because of the conditions of the factory. They unionized, they became radical. One of Cowie's interesting points is that one of the things you hear over and over again in South Central Indiana, because it's such an interesting location for this type of study, South Central Indiana is not quite the north, it's not quite the south, it's not quite rural, it's not quite urban. It has its own brand of resistance. It has its own brand of acquiescence to these processes. And one of the things you hear all over and over again as it is deindustrialized is those darn Mexicans are stealing our jobs. A lot of these industrial factories have moved to Mexico. What the Hoosiers, as they call themselves, or we call ourselves now, never say is that we were the Mexicans. We were the Mexicans for the Camden RCA workers. That's what they were. They stole the jobs of the Camden RCA workers. So it's really a fascinating place to study these kind of cultural geographies. So through this examination of the geography of class in South Central Indiana, I'd like to make three main points today. First, that like transnational corporations, working people in South Central Indiana are flexible, and the spatial fixes that they seek are often fragmented and not just structured by class interests. Second, that working people in this region, as in other areas, are never the hapless victims of the movements of capital, but are themselves the producers of space and the producers of history. And finally, that the spatial fixes of both capital and labor contribute to the formation and reformation of class boundaries and are defining of how class works. So that's my view of class as well. As many of us, class is a very fluid category, it's a very contested category. And I'm saying that space and spatial production really plays a very crucial role in the production and reproduction of class lines. So I start off with this quote from Jack Welch. The full quote is, ideally, you'd have every plant you own on a barge to move with currencies and changes in the economy. And Welch was speaking to Lou Dobbs, of all people, in 1998 on CNN. He goes on to say, you can't do that, but the job of the company is to be agile and to capitalize on these things, but it's a tough economy. So Welch is saying, he's admitting that even a company like GE doesn't have the power to simply relocate wherever it wants. If it did, every company from the beginning of the circulation of capital on would always locate where the cheapest labor money is. But they don't do that. They can't. There's other considerations that have to be taken into account. But Welch, importantly, I think he's an important symbolic figure more than anything else. He's one of the first CEOs to really attack the idea of the American corporation, the idea of our national economy. And he said, there's no loyalty to GE. There's no loyalty to the national economy. There's no loyalty to America and capitalism. There's loyalty to the stockholders and the profit margin. And that's it. And if we do that, we'll be fine. And so he becomes kind of famous for that. And while he's doing this, he also admits that he can't achieve his utopia of pure flexible accumulation of, as I quote, life on a barge floating down the Mississippi of profit and limitless labor availability. It's Richard Walker, who's a geographer, who points out that it is geographers studying trends of globalization who first illustrated that companies like GE cannot, quote, ignore the assets of place or move on a dime. As our recent speculative boom highlights, spatial fixes, according to Walker, quote,
are often speculative in the extreme and based on nothing more than collective madness. Capital's freewheeling operations can impede its own further profit making if not done with care. So when companies, if they move without taking a proper plan, they can actually destroy their own profit margin. So capitalist corporations are not, you know, they're not omniscient. They often make mistakes. They often act against their own self-interest, as they've done in Arden's recent crash. Workers are the same way. Workers don't often and always act in resistance to capital and resistance to what we apparently oppress them. What GE and other formerly American companies can do, though, is make moves within their supply distribution chains that increase profitability. Working within limitations, each move in GE's spatial fix alters the network of connections, linking and delinking actors and materials along lines of production, distribution, and consumption, and setting workers against each other in the global race to the bottom. So that's what they can do. They can also, importantly, utilize the rhetoric of relocation, that's something that I hope to touch on here, to alter the spatial perceptions of both local politicians and working people. The geographic mobility of companies means that they can transition from being American corporations while many in the workforce lack the same mobility, discipline, culture. I'm, of course, not the first person to make this point. While CEOs like Welch and their political supporters were busy dismantling the national economy, it is true that many American workers were slow to catch on to the fact that those who operated the companies they worked for no longer consider themselves to be running American companies or participating in anything like a national economy. As they caught on, their collective attitudes and outlooks regarding work, home, and community space have been altered. The attitude of GE workers, which I'm mostly talking about, so I'm talking about GE in Southern Indiana, which is located in Bloomington. The attitude of GE workers at the peak of prosperity in the Bloomington plant, which was the 1970s and 1980s, was one of pride, upward mobility, and a confident consumerism, but it was also one embedded in a tenuousness. That outlook has now changed with deindustrialization to one of fear, suspicion, reactionary politics, but a stubborn optimism that the companies that will come back. And this is, my research so far has been based on a lot of conversations with people who both are still working at the rump of GE and former GE workers, and they express this constantly that it's not going to work. Moving to cheap production facilities is just overall, in the long term, it's not going to work. It's going to come back at some point. But we've also developed in South Central Indiana and in other places what the sociologist Brian Sparks has shown to be a lack of confidence in what used to be the American dream. And there's an irony here about the GE workers. These GE workers that I'm talking to a lot, these guys literally produced the physical artifact of the American dream in Bloomington. You know what they produced? The double door refrigerator freezer with the thing inside with the ice maker inside. I mean, it's the literalization of the suburban American dream. And what you find in a lot of the interviews with guys, with these people who work for GE, is that they've lost that confidence that consumerism basically is going to be part of an ongoing American dream. So they've developed an identity crisis about who they are as Americans, who they are as workers. And I think it's actually it matches up with South Central Indiana itself. South Central Indiana has itself an identity crisis. Again, it's not quite the North, it's not quite the South. Indiana itself is a copperhead state. For those of you who don't know American history, copperheads were people who lived in the North but who did not support the Civil War against the Southern states. So it was right on the borderline of the South. It's north of the line separating slave and free states. But it's always had that kind of mixed politics and mixed culture. So this is the culture that companies like RCA and GE and Otis Elevator moved into in the post-war period, seeking their spatial fix. So as more industry moved to the region, unionization brought higher wages and produced a working class upper class, whose wage and benefit package established the ceiling of working class prosperity while raising the bottom for most unskilled workers in the region. While there are many versions of that constitute what I'll call the upper working class, GE workers shared certain similarities with other unionized workers in the region. For the pre-NAFTA period, GE workers shared wage and benefit levels, outlooks and attitudes, rates of unionization, and neighborhoods with other upper working classes, such as those who worked for RCA, Otis Elevator, and other large manufacturers. So these guys set the pace for the working class in this area. They really did. They set the pace on things like what constituted upward mobility, how you raised your children, They demanded community services like playgrounds and parks and things like that. They really were a working class elite. Their wages showed it out, their benefit packages. They raised the level of wages and benefits for the unskilled working class and the non-unionized working class, which also constituted them as a problem for a lot of business owners in this area. So the movement of industry into Monroe County, South Central Indiana, created a strong union presence whose members often expressed militancy as a self-confident nationalism and the belief that as a consuming class, their positions were somehow protected. And this is something that comes through in conversations over and over again. The phrase we never thought it would end. What these people really believed was that as consumers of the products they were making, they were vital in this chain. So they, and the other phrase you hear over and over again is, and Cowie found this as well, are those Mexicans going to be able to afford these washers and dryers? Are they going to be able to afford these televisions? And if they can't, the system isn't going to work. They didn't count on endless consumer credit, I think, was one of the things that has driven the process. But this idea that was never going to end was something that we get over and over again from talking to people, that the prosperity was going to go on. So as industry slowly moved out of the region, the self-conception of the region's working class altered with the changes in the industrial geography. General Electric began its movement out of Monroe County in the mid-90s. The plant in Bloomington has been reduced from a peak of 4,500 workers unionized to about 500. And the only reason that GE really keeps that front of a plant open is so that they don't have to provide technical assistance to the workers. If they close the plant, it changes their legal obligations to their workers. So the GE workforce experienced many of the same jolts felt previously by workers at RCA and Otis and these other plants. They made numerous concessions that had little effect on job saving. They were whipsawed, as they called it, by being put into competition with workers at other plants like the Louisville plant. And with the massive reduction in workforce, they experienced the loss of confidence that accompanies dislocation. But of course, they were never passive. All the while, whether intentionally or otherwise, they produced historical space. Labor geographer Andrew Herron, who I base a lot of my work off of, asked the question, quote, how might different groups with different sets of interests seek to manipulate geographical organization to their own benefit, end quote. I would alter the question slightly and ask how geographical or spatial fixes fragment groups that might have a similar set of interests. So in other words, how does working class spatial production itself lead to class formation within working class groups? And so in what can be thought of as the prosperous years for GE workers, they did manipulate geographical organizations in a variety of ways. I just want to walk through a couple of them and then talk about the ones that are most important. So these were contested spaces and spaces that were produced by the GE working unionized working class. Control over the shop floor, obviously, that was one space that they always contested. They created working class enclaves. You can see this in the area where I live. I'm a professor at Indiana University. I live with all the artists and other professors in the city of Bloomington. There's nobody who works in a union that lives in the city of Bloomington. They don't like to go there. They don't like to go downtown. They all live in these small townships on the outskirts of the city. And these were real working class enclaves, constituting themselves as working class enclaves based on homeownership, based on the type of entertainment we took in, places like the Starlight Drive-In, which is still a working class enclave, the youth athletic complexes. These are all things that these working class people demanded. More important, and this is one of the things I'm finding with this research, is that there was a demand for upward mobility for their sons and daughters, which created a demand for increased community college, which means that Ivy Tech, which is a community college system in Indiana, the unified community college system, really expanded its presence in this area. So you've got this expanded presence of community college. You've got a pro-labor city council in places like Bloomington, a much more pro-labor politics amongst the township councils, all of these things. So as GE is moving out, as other manufacturers are moving out, this kind of spatial production is taking place. And it really is important, and it really has worked in an interesting way. Because as these industrial jobs have been lost, I'm not saying that every worker has taken advantage of retraining programs, but if I had my PowerPoint, I had this great picture of Ivy Tech and this voltaic cell class that they run to retrain workers for the green economy, and that kind of infrastructure is the direct result of the prosperity of this working class from the 70s, 80s, and the 90s. It's the space that they themselves were producing. So what this means, I'll wrap it up by saying, I'll actually just read the conclusions. It's actually pretty easy to get through. One result of capital's mobility in South Central Indiana has been the forced rethinking about nationalism, Americanism, and what it means to be a citizen of the United States. One thing that most of these workers made clear is that their view of what constitutes America and American community is not shared by politicians of either major party, and is indeed a conception that does not appear to them to be defensible in any real sense. So a lot of these ex-union workers or even current union workers have really given up this idea that somehow they are American and America is going to protect them. They've abandoned it. Where you really see that is one step lower down the economic scale in South Central Indiana. The unskilled, non-unionized working class, what we call the working poor, still hold on to that kind of Americanism. But most of these GE workers in particular, they're much more sophisticated. They know that's never coming back. Let's not even pay attention to that. So they're kind of rethinking what it means to be a national citizen. The other thing, the post-natal period in South Central Indiana and the expanded mobility of capital has redrawn the geography of class in the region. While the trade agreement itself only accelerated processes already in place, NAFTA clearly marks a rhetorical point of departure for South Central Indiana's working class elite. NAFTA is not the reason these jobs have left. The jobs are leaving already, but every one of these guys that you talk to, guys and girls, I'm sorry, I use guys. Everyone you talk to says NAFTA, 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 over and over again. The first thing that comes up, anytime you ask them about it, the economy in the region, they refer back to NAFTA. What all this means for the formation of class in South Central Indiana is that fragmentation and solidarity continue. But the forces pushing these processes have changed. Where previously class positions within South Central Indiana's working class were determined first by industrial relocation to the area and the ability of workers to obtain and maintain a good union job. The relocation of industry has meant that working class divides are determined by how one has adjusted to the new geography of capital. My preliminary examination of the current state of class geography in South Central Indiana makes several things clear, while perhaps obscuring other points. First, it is clear that class remains a slippery category in the region as well as other areas, and with a definable working class whose internal divisions render it fragmented. So your access to this kind of retraining is now determinant of your position within the working class and how you can, you know, your level of security. Second, what is also clear is that working people in the region have adjusted to the transition from neoliberal economic order within a spatial world that they themselves create, and they remain active agents in the process. What is unclear, perhaps necessarily, is what the future holds for working people in South Central Indiana, and what solidarities and fragmentations might arise from the constant production of space. So,
cultural historian working primarily in a 20th century United States context and has published extensively in several areas. In the field of utopian studies, two recent chapters can be found in the 2009 publication, Transforming Utopia, and the 2007 publication, Remapping the Humanities. His 2004 article, Utopian Aspirations in the Black Freedom Movement, in the journal Utopian Studies won an award for Best Journal Article that year. His overlapping interest in the Black Freedom Movement and particularly the role of students and white activists in that movement has resulted in a chapter in the 2009 ABC CLIO Reader Civil Rights Movement People and Perspectives and a forthcoming book tentatively entitled Shall We Overcome? White Activists in the Black Freedom Movement and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Recent publications on the history of U.S. imperialism and its global and domestic repercussions include a 2010 book, Dying and Fire, U.S. Imperialism and Global Resistance, a 2010 article on war in an era of declining U.S. hegemony in the Journal of Critical Globalization, and the entry on the American Century in 2009, Sharp Encyclopedia of the Cultural Wars. American activist in peace, justice, and international solidarity campaigns. He's a longtime board member of the Michigan Commission for Human Rights and a new board member of Historians Against War. The title of his talk today is U.S. Consumers and the Problematics of Solidarity. solidarity with global Swiss shop workers. Ladies and gentlemen, French.
Thank you. Wow. This is a shameless self-promotion. Just because I, my book that just came out by Rutledge Press, which I hope to somehow make available on a website that I have, dyingyourheart.org, since the price that they put it at is absolutely ridiculous. So what I'm talking about is actually a segment of chapter 3 in my book called Afflicted Solidarities. And what I want to do is really pick up to some extent on what Alpin said and what Joe said, because I am trying to deal with both agency and spatial fix. But what I'm trying to do also is make accessible to a more general reader some of the theory that I think undergirds a lot of all of our work. So what I'm going to try to do is to read a little bit of the excerpt so you can see that this is accessible for undergraduates. And basically what I'm trying to outline, that you can see from the handout that I've given, is how do we wrestle with the issue of solidarity in an imperial country. How do we have solidarity with third world people in developing nations, particularly those people working in global sweatshops? So I lay out a couple of definitions of solidarity that you have in front of you, and then try to pick up on Sally Schultz's wonderful book on political solidarity, where she helps to problematize what it means to try to overcome gender, class, racial privilege, but also and my focus on the issue of national privilege. So we get the difficulties of renouncing privilege. Secondly, the problems of fully understanding the situation and experience of the oppressed. That is how we make connections, how we really have and connect with the phenomenological reality of folks in other countries. And the impediments of participating in an act of resistance. What does it mean to engage in a consumer-led campaign for issues of solidarity. So briefly, I think we're all sort of familiar with what the whole history of outsourcing and subcontracting has been. And of course, what it's allowed then U.S.-based corporations, transnational corporations to do is to sort of wipe their hands and say, oh, we don't really own anything anymore. Like the Disney spokesperson who said about their factory in Haiti where they were producing Disney apparel. Well, we don't even pay anybody in Haiti. You know, it's just the subcontractors who they have to worry about. And of course, they've taken advantage of the export processing zones. And one example of the EPZ in the walled city of Rosario in the Philippines, 90 miles south of Manila, where manufacturing such goods as Nike shoes, Gap pajamas, and Old Navy jeans. So you can see all those manufacturers, apparel manufacturers in the U.S. taking advantage of this one APC, for example, in Manila. Of course, primarily the workers there being younger women who work, as we all know, incredibly long hours with ridiculously low pay. So they're laboring at least 12 hours a day under very harsh conditions. According to one observer, quote, bathrooms are padlocked except during 2 15-minute breaks, during which time all workers have to sign in and out so management can keep track of their non-productive time. Seamstresses at a factory sewing garments for Gap, Guess, and Old Navy sometimes had to resort to urinating in plastic bags under their machines. Such disciplinary regimes often reflected the orientation of or neglect by the national government. In fact, many U.S. firms favored countries where the government was under the influence of imperial dominance or authoritarian rule. In this regard, it is instructive to follow the trajectory of Nike as it has moved from one lower-wage country to the next. And for those of you who have seen Michael Moore's film, where he really follows Phil Knight and tries to appeal to Phil Knight, the CEO of Nike, here are all these workers in Flint, Michigan, you know, the deindustrialized Flint, Michigan, and they would really work at your factory for anything you paid them. Oh no, we can't pay them that though, so we go to the Philippines and we'll
ago, so Vietnam will pay them even lower over there. As one analysis by the International Security Company noted, Nike tends to favor strong governments, for example, strong governments, authoritarian governments. For example, Nike was a major producer in both Korea and Taiwan when these countries were under military rule. Furthermore, as both Korea and Taiwan moved away from military rule and U.S. domination and towards independent militant unions, Nike sought out more stable governments, essentially moving to authoritarian and low-wage environments in Indonesia, Vietnam, and China. As a consequence of the media glare in the United States and a consumer campaign against its labor practices, Nike was forced to deploy a public relations counterattack that featured a high-profile tour by Andrew Young, former ambassador to the UN under President Jimmy Carter, and a well-known civil rights advocate. When Young reported that all of the Nike factories he visited in Vietnam, Indonesia, and China were without, quote, evidence of widespread or systematic abuse or mistreatment of workers, unquote, the director of Vietnam Labor Watch, Toyen Nguyen, commented that Young's tours were conducted by management, and he talked to workers through Nike interpreters. Workers were not about to complain in front of the boss, especially in authoritarian countries where workers labeled troublemakers can be fired in jail. As NGOs continued to contradict Nike's claims, a growing campaign against Nike in the late 1990s led the company to expand its corporate social responsibility department to over 90 members. So this was like a public relations opportunity for Nike to try to prove that it's really not a human rights abuser in any sense. Appearing at global meetings, arranging for audits of their factories, Nike and other U.S. apparel manufacturers that have engaged in protracted deceptions aimed at diffusing and misleading the anti-sweatshop movements in the United States. On the one hand, striking Vietnamese Nike factory workers and labor rights activists have tried to spotlight the continuing lack of decent wages and working conditions, and here's the agency of folks in other countries. According to one Chinese observer, quote, the retailers and their suppliers are playing the louder game. They only want to reassure customers not to really change working conditions. There were some instances that Nike, responding to pressure by anti-sweatshop movement in the U.S., raised the minimum wage, especially in the 1990s in Indonesia. And again, it's a consequence of the action and agency on the ground of Indonesian workers with some of the public glare comes in the anti-sweatshop campaign movement. However, when Indonesian workers struck for better conditions, their leaders were fired and denounced as troublemakers by Nike and the local press. Thus, Nike hid behind the CSR shield, their corporate social responsibility, in the United States, persisting, however, in making life miserable for its employees abroad. Another high-profile anti-sweatshop campaign in the 1990s was organized by the U.S.-based National Labor Committee against Gap Incorporated and its garment supplier in El Salvador, Mandarin International. After the majority women workers at Mandarin established an independent union, the company not only resisted recognition of the union, but also retaliated against prominent union members. You know, the same old story of picking off the leadership. The NLC Gap campaign went into high gear, sponsoring a tour in 1995 featuring one of the fired Mandarin International female workers. Feeling the pressure from its effective media campaign, Gap signed an agreement with NLC to oversee the fair resolution of any labor disputes in El Salvador and to work towards humane working conditions at Mandarin. However, according to one study of what actually occurred with the workers on the ground, quote, while the campaign, its resolution independent monitoring project, have served to assure Gap Inc.'s brand name has made Gap Inc. retail outlets safe once more for progressive-minded shopping, their effects on the shop floor have been either ambiguous or, in some cases, unqualifiedly negative. In other words, there's that sort of imperial screen that we have filtering out what appears to be the harsher conditions under which people still have to operate while the propaganda machine of the corporations continues to play on its idea that we're making you responsible shoppers. In the late 1990s, college students took up the fight against global sweatshops that produced their school apparel. The primary national organization that grew out of the local anti-sweatshop campaigns on campuses, United Students Against Sweatshops, was founded in 1998. Bringing together more than 180 campus groups, USAS activists recognized, in the words of one student anti-sweatshop protester at the University of North Carolina, we can think of the university itself as a brand, a logo that students consume, and then picking up on Naomi Klein's wonderful no logo, and begin to push that, what that means in terms of what the university logo actually represented in terms of the work that's on the ground. Beyond the university logo, the centrality of the youth market to consumer capitalism, corporate advertising, informed the consciousness and political sensibilities of many of those in the USAS. According to Liana Molino from Santa Clara University, quote, the system is completely dependent on us going out and spending money on all this crap. So, you sort of get students at that point of understanding and being aware of the addiction of consumerism and trying to hold, to some standard beyond that. And yet, at the same time, this is sort of part of the environment in which they inhabit. Nevertheless, by foregrounding the role of a privileged consumer in the United States, such anti-sweatshop campaigns, quote, have had the potential to reinforce the notion that agency is based in the United States and that contention occurs only at the heights of the political program, not on the ground floor. They also potentially reinforce the conception that local conditions are created by global forces rather than through struggles and negotiations in all sites. This is a quote from what I think is one of the best books on this transnational phenomenon of activism. It's a book by Ethel Brooks, 2007, University of Minnesota, called Unraveling the Garment Industry. On the other hand, because of concerted efforts by North American students to visit global sweatshops in the South, and I want to maintain that this act of engaging with people on the ground, actually becoming accompanying them, it's the old way we used to talk about it for those who, us who, as I was in Witness for Peace, where we'd go down to Nicaragua and actually live among the Nicaraguans who were under siege by the United States and its particular Contra War. Anyhow, in addition to traveling to Mexico, Nicaragua, Honduras during the first half of 2000 to investigate conditions inside and outside garment factories, USAS delegations paid attention to workers' struggles to achieve self-determination on and off the job. Eschewing the discourse of victimization, these are merely victims without agency, that often accompanies images of third world workers, USAS activist Molly McGrath emphasizes that organization has, quote, tried to change the rhetoric to sow sweatshop workers with more agency and power. Some of the reporting of these visits to the Global South on USAS websites highlights the roles of specific workers in forming independent unions and reflecting on their involvement as young women and men in labor struggles. Quote, represented in this way, with the emphasis on their humanity and their power rather than on their suffering, sweatshop workers seem more real, even to a privileged first world audience, unquote. In conjunction with the visitations to sweatshops in the Global South, USAS activists engaged in a wave of anti-sweatshop sit-ins in 2000. From Penn to Oregon, Wisconsin to Tulane, students demonstrated against not only campus corporate connections companies like Nike and the selling of the swoosh. You can't help every college football team now has a swoosh somewhere, right? But also in favor of college commitments to the Worker Rights Consortium, WRC, instead of the more corporate-friendly Fair Labor Association. So there's actually a contestation and an effect going on about the labeling then of what constituted corporate responsibility for these corporations that had global sweatshops. Although many university administrations refused to demand to leave the FLA and join the WRC, some going as far to break up USAS sit-ins by brutal police intervention, other universities signed up with the WRC. Nevertheless, the economic lobbying and political power of corporations like Nike resulted in applying pressure to enforce their apparel arrangements with specific institutions of higher learning. Especially egregious example of Nike bullying came when CEO Phil McKnight withdrew a $30 million offer to the University of Washington for a new sports stadium after Oregon joined the WRC. After the administration of Oregon reversed its membership, Nike revived its offer. Nike also tried to buy the goodwill of citizens and youth in various cities around the United States, from Portland and New York City. Nike proposed a gift of $500,000 in cash and athletic gear to the deficit-ridden Portland School Board. Although the board, eventually we heard some of the discussion of, you know, charter schools, but you also got corporations operating at another level also in the urban areas with promoting, you know, corporate products. Although the board eventually succumbed to Nike's offers, there was intense debate and division. One of the Asian members of the board confessed his own moral and ethical dilemma that Nike contributed the money so my children can have a better education, but at whose expense? And this is the connection, the solidarity connection. At the expense of children who work for 6 cents an hour? It's an injury to one, it's an injury to all. Contradictions between Nike's operations abroad and conditions in the U.S. are especially evident in depressed inner cities, where youth are special targets of Nike marketing and sponsored sports programs, such as promoting, you know, Air Jordans, Michael Jordan, and the sort of icons for it. One community organizer, The Rock, contended that we really got angry because they, Nike, were taking so much money from us here and then going to other countries and exploiting people even worse. We want our kids to see how it affects them here on the streets, but also here on the streets, affecting people in Southeast Asia. So again, that kind of reciprocal kind of relationship. As a result of this anger, a campaign was organized by Latino and Black youth from the Bronx and other parts of New York City to collect old Nike shoes, dump them at Nike Town in Midtown Manhattan. At almost the exact same time, however, that this high-profile demonstration took place in fashionable Fifth Avenue, a teenage boy was murdered another teenager for his Air Nike Jordans in West Orange City. In the face of such tragedies, consumer awareness of Nike's exploitative practices at home and abroad led to increased efforts by city and towns throughout the United States in the 90s to sign on the anti-sweatshop campaigns, by passing local ordinances requiring city governments to purchase non-sweatshop manufactured uniforms for public employees, including members of the police and fire departments. To some extent, USAF and sweatshop garment workers have gained incremental victories against corporate giants like Nike at the site of some contractors in the global south. One such success was the Hukong International Factory in Atlántico de Pueblo, Mexico, with contracts for Nike and Reebok to produce sweatshirts for numerous universities, including Oregon and Michigan. Hukong workers in contact with USAS activists formed an independent union to voice their grievances against poor food, wages, and working conditions. After the Nike's workers went out on strike, students from the USAS picket lines formed around Nike stores in number of cities and used WRC agreements to enlist university administrations along with Nike and Reebok. With this pressure and additional political intervention, the Kuntan workers won a collective bargaining agreement. Another example of the symbiotic solidarity of USAS and the Mexican garment workers resulted in elevating issues around women workers from asserting languages in one independent union contract, outlawing sexual harassment and guaranteeing equal representation among union officers. Certainly these examples and others reflect an element of solidarity that does not diminish the agency of third world people, especially women in the global sweatshop. On the other hand, certain high-profile anti-sweatshop campaigns illuminate the contradictions of a racialized and gendered imperial consumption and its afflicted solidarity. Perhaps the most notorious case of such contradictions and afflicted solidarity was a consumer campaign that targeted talk show host Kathy Lee Gifford and her clothing line produced at Walmart's, subcontracting sweatshops in Central America and the United States. Some of you know about this. It was taken on by Charlie Carnahan and the NLC in the 90s. But what transpired reinforced the sense that the story was ultimately about well-intentioned U.S. consumers and transnational corporations. Instead of emphasizing the agency of Latina and Asian women workers, Gifford became the crucial change agent. As poignantly summarized by academic investigator Ethel Brooks, the entire debate, the entire campaign was translated into one about whether American power, American idealism, and American democratic values will be redeemed. The redemption would be symbolic and would be embodied by Kathy Lee Gifford, a symbol of how the aberrant space of the global sweatshop could be civilized through the practice of transnational redemptive white womanhood. So again, here you get that racialized spatial fix and salvation of one spatially, mother country. And displacing the focus of how real solidarity with local struggles and agents in the garment industry of the global south can be developed, U.S. imperial culture and its privileged consumers reinforce the fiction that deception capitalism, something I talked about a little bit earlier, along with destructive, with the Nike shock doctrine that Naomi Klein talks about. And there's the localist Black Herald concerning lifting the living standard of poor third world people. Again, Brooks punctures the imperial missionary arrogance embedded in such claims. This process of salvation and solidarity's name is a reenactment of earlier old colonial salvations of an entire history of taking up the white man's burdens. Against this imperial affliction stands the alternative ethical and political responsibility, something that Schultz talks about, and I use bell hooks also, where we stand, class manner. Found in those inspiring moments when USAS activists and their co-workers in the global justice movement realized, albeit in a temporary manner, that solidaristic connection between the local and the global. In their May Day missive to the USAS, the Cook workers in Mexico articulated an authentic solidarity of ethical and political responsibility. We know that at times our faith is lost, but as long as we are together with each other, we will give each other the spirit to move forward, because we know that what we do will be good for others in any part of the world.
One comment. I come from Pakistan, respect with country.
Yes.
You know how labor movements go there, and only students, the unions that are really strong there are student unions. But unfortunately, that those student leaders, they go into politics. And what happens is they become fierce politicians and they forget about the labor. They only remember their own interests. And that is really sad. But once there was a factory, a big factory near Lahore, a big city in Pakistan, and there was a labor problem there. So what happened is the factory was closed, and 3 years later when I went there, building had been demolished, and there was a housing scheme there, big, expensive homes, and you can then imagine from the moment. So that is really a sad part of how we face the world there. If you have any questions from the panelists, we don't have much time, but still.
This is for Joseph. I was elected president a lot, and I was just wondering how you viewed the movement of technology, which is definitely going to be fragmenting all the spaces you talked about, because it's making it global, but making each area of influence smaller.
Right.
Have you factored that in, and does that eventually mean that labor is necessarily going to be diminished?
Yeah, that's good. One of the things that I find interesting about the repetition of almost a mantra-like repetition of NAFTA, 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 is that the technology was already undergirding the ability to hold on to these union jobs. It's already underway. It's been underway, right, since 1774 or whatever. I don't know if we can pinpoint the exact date when the original steam pump changed into a steam engine. It's constantly working to eliminate jobs, but then it's also working to create new ones. And so,
I think if you look at historically, you had the landed people who owned land controlling everything. Mm-hmm. Then it moved to in the 19th century to capitalists controlling everything.
Right.
And now it's information. So the people who control information. Mm-hmm. But think about information; it's free. Anybody
right.
can take it.
It
doesn't
right.
have a property value.
Well, here's what's interesting about that kind of technology. You guys, I was going to show that great slide of they're making the voltaic cells at Iberia teaching. These former line workers had to work with the green technology. Advances in technology right now, I think, are really bringing about a real realization of what Marx was talking about with forces of production. That when you factor in everything, you factor in the way that people are using these new technologies, all of those things mean that all of those forces of production are in fact exceeding our existing legal and constitutional systems. And they will in fact overthrow them. We won't be able to pinpoint the date. It may not be a political revolution, but it's going to be a revolution that's going to, maybe a slow evolution, that's going to overthrow the current system of ownership and legality. I hate to say we have to wait for it or anything like that. In the meantime, people are suffering. No, in the meantime, we have to keep organizing. But it's already there. It's always been there. So I'm not sure if I'm addressing.
Well, unfortunately, is class conflict just diminishing? Because of that, before you had these two best interests, the people with and the people without.
Right.
Now with the technology movement, you are actually getting into a situation where potentially everybody with education has it.
Is class conflict diminishing, or are class lines once again being completely redrawn and reproduced? I think that's the best I can, say. God, if I had an answer to that, I'd be famous probably. It is a great question. I mean, I think that is actually what I'm trying to deal with here, is how do those class lines get redrawn, reproduced, constantly contested, because of these changes, and obviously, yeah, technology has a lot to do with it. Yeah, I wish I had the answer to that. I wish I had a one-shot answer to that. It'd make a great book, and I'd be famous.
And I do have another question, but I see that we have 4 minutes left. So I'm going to just say I would love to hear how workers engage the state in this process, this creation and creation of their own boundaries and spaces. So what are the expectations they have of this state that might have abandoned them? It still seems to me like some of this is placement of the state, like the training So how, the same thing with your presentation, I think that the state is within the absent agency. But I do have some very concrete questions for our colleagues. And I found the presentation fascinating, as we are important, but several important questions. One is that in the struggle in the garment factory, were women workers there? So women are engaged in it. And more generally, because I also find fascinating your description about the relationship of people and their identity as workers. And I wonder if you had a chance to ask questions as to how they remember, how they reconstruct their past as an individual and collective as workers at some other stage. Like, I have a sense that this is a process, this is a community in the process of transition. Is there any common history of them or something that they remember collectively as workers that bring some of that identity to them, or is
you remember the first collective struggle case that I was talking about, the union as factory, which unfortunately moderate. For example, those guys, I'm saying guys because they were mostly guys, when they come together, in case and stuff like that, issue comes up, they really like very much to, for example, talk about that struggle because they won, And because of that victory, they always keep talking about that. Experience. We are so good and stuff like that. But afterwards they all become dispersed. They all go to different workshops. Many of them are still unemployed, since 1.5 years because of the crisis.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really make anything visible. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It only comes up in personal conversations.
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed both the presentations. I just had a question. Quite a short time, but just so how do we configure space and work when space is in movement? I'll give you an example. Because I think we're continuously running behind the eight ball in terms of how capitalism figures to, restructures itself. Is the paper industry. Paper industry now, Jack Welch's desires have come to fruition. They put the factory on a ship. The ship picks up the pulp in Southeast Asia. And when it's disembarked in California, it's in paper. And the bottom of the ship is a factory with workers. And the paper is produced on the ship as it's moving from one place to the other. So that creates a series of problems. So in terms of space, first of all, because the factory is moving. Second of all, as far as national claims are concerned, these workers belong to what country and under what legislation do they work? And as for the ship itself, and this is something real. This is not right. Something that they, this is actually happening.
Sounds like sci-fi, but it's not. Right?
No, it's not. The paper comes in pulp in one end and comes out paper when they dock the ship in the U.S. So this creates a whole new thing. Well, if you can do this with paper, you can do it with a bunch of other things.
I don't know if you were in on the discussion last night, I guess it was there, but we were talking about Linebaugh and Redeker, and we were talking about the trading ship from the 1700s, and how it became this proto-factory, right, an early industrial factory, what's being produced as trade. And I think we might be able to think of this in the same way. Maybe I'm being utopian, but this is, if it's a new form, it's also a new way for working people to exchange information and come into contact with and link up systems, just as capital is linking those systems as well. So I think I don't mean to be overly optimistic and utopian. We should look at that as an opportunity. That's actually an opportunity. You're sounding very pessimistic about it, and I'm thinking of it as, wow, there's an opportunity for those workers to redraw the lines of what it means to be a national citizen, of what labor law means, and what are the limits of labor law. But like everything else, it comes back to they have to be organized. They have, and you know, there's no we that can do it for them, is there? I mean, we can do what we do, but they have to organize. They have to produce the historical space. They can reach out for allies, of course, and they're going to have to, and they're going to. But maybe that movement gives them more opportunities to reach out for different allies. That's probably very unsatisfying.
And like what is it? They can seize the boat.
Yes, pirates, right? Yeah. They can seize the boat. And you pirates, exactly. They could.
That's right. No, yeah. I'm only partially joking.
Yeah.
The only problem with that is you seize a factory, you go to jail, you seize a boat, you get hungry.
But the national
What's that?
Back in the 20s and 30s, the national
That's using boats, right? Because they are defensible.
Yeah.
A boat is defensible, yeah. and a public relations disaster would be killing everybody. Hey, some people have to die sometimes for things to change. So, you know.
Can I request you to keep your comments? We are already over time, but I saw three more hands, and after that, we will take this.
I wanted to ask how that, when there's this movement like the barricading that you're describing, that, like, how vigorously does the state respond to this? How much is it arrest for people? How much force is this?
So this is because the police did not really behave very harshly to them. Obviously, because they were very much right. Obviously, because the guy just ran away with all of those monies, you know. So the police was actually quite collaborating. They went and they find out there are two buses actually. The one was like the bigger one. He ran away. The policeman and find the other guy and made some kind of informal words from him to say the purpose about that they will somehow pay them. That was kind of like the end of the situation of the trade. Also because of that, the deal of the
I just wrote down a couple of stuff to North Americans. This time was the side of many, many famous football teams, and one of the sides of the working class helped people football. And I'm wondering if in the Tunisian Istanbul, if there's a famous soccer team through which and across which some of these differences, in a sense, get cut. In other words, differences are put aside at least for 90 minutes every Saturday. is there anything typical?
I am not really soccer guy, but there is one, but. You might have some business.
We were talking yesterday, so maybe
we'll have a conversation after. But we have one Istanbul team which is quite known in this pronunciation in Thailand, which is Beşiktaş.
Is Gala, the elite?
It's like middle.
Beşiktaş is like middle. They hate each other. They kill each other.
We have last question. I just want to put it on anyone I want to talk to. But I know in seeing some of the things that even are happening in China and the various things that are rural migrants from Canada, it sounds very similar to a lot of what we're talking about. But I was at a panel discussion in Washington, and from China, talking about it, raising these questions. They took the question of the weakening of the nation state with the very capital to the state and capital to the left. So, like, what was going on? Because if they did take strong.
You're all right, Joan. I got you back.
Bring up the standard of the 1% capital, the factor is the government, which they did. So, I don't know if anyone has any ideas or comments on this subject about the power that the state has over capital.
I tend to lean towards the anarchist position when I see the littering of the state as a good thing. Even though it may cause problems right now, you get rid of it through working people's own actions, and they don't necessarily need what we. This is just me, and I'm not going to get enemies by saying this.
We haven't come across any of these things where it's sort of like they're saying, well, it's not really America's fault. It's not really China's fault. It's not really whatever.
The issue the role of the state, and if you look at, let's take Venezuela, if you look at what has happened in Latin America with the arrival of national popular leaders who come out of social movements like Evo Morales in Bolivia. But in Venezuela, what is being done now is the state is helping to set up programs for cooperative factories, so that you cooperatize more of the factories under worker management. So the degree to which the state can create an alternative structure that will, at some point perhaps, Chavez talks about it as 21st century socialism. The question is, to what degree is it a replication of 20th century socialism, or to what degree will these worker co-ops eventually undermine the role of capital?
Will that work well if we could get rid of Chavez?
If you have a state which is comes out of a social struggle at the base, which is throws up a leader like Morales, for example, you're still going to have contradictions of the national popular struggle. But at the same time, you're going to have the possibility for the state to use some of its instrumentality to create spaces by which workers can move into organizing themselves and creating the capacity for alternative structures. So that seems to me to be one possibility. And you've got all sorts of other struggles in China.
But with the state as a manager of capital, we have done very well so far.
Yeah, exactly. That doesn't even make as much progress.
You talk about the military, U.S. money, creating these military dictatorships that make it a great plan for investment.
Absolutely.
So that's another obligation of U.S. citizens. We need to get free of that money for social services, whatever, and just stop propping up. You follow the money, not just capital, it's also militarism.
Exactly.
Keeps you from using power. On behalf of capital and broadcast dollars that should go around the world.
Thank you to all of our